Start of interview with Sir Arthur G. Ranasinghe on the 12th of August, 1967.
Interview with Sir Arthur Ranasinghe. Open square bracket. I'm afraid that a portion of the interview was not recorded. I will provide the gist of this section of this. A portion of the interview at the commencement was not recorded. I will provide the gist. This section as far as I can remember it. I opened with an inquiry on the ethos of the civil service. I want I asked Sir Arthur whether the British civil servants of the 1920s and 1930s, I asked Sir Arthur what the attitude of the British civil servants of the 1920s and 1930s was, and for example whether they had an elitist concept. Sir Arthur Ranasinghe replied that in those days the civil service had been divided into two divisions, the upper division and the local division, and most of the Sirhanis were in the local division. It was believed then that the Sirhanis did not have an aptitude for, or have the aptitude or ability to handle administrative matters. However, the politicians had been agitating on this issue and wanted to amalgamate the civil service, and this had eventually been done around about 1921 or 1922. While, of course, while this division had, though this division existed, all were members of the civil service, and as soon as they were joined, entered the civil service, were buttonholed and you had to pay, and you joined the Civil Service Association and paid subs, etc. And the Europeans, the office bearers were generally Europeans. They treated the Sirhanis as if they said, "We are all brothers." But in practice, the color of your skin did have a bearing on the postings which you received. Thus, for instance, Sirhanis, and even T.W. Roberts were shunted into such posts, into non-revenue administrative posts. My father, T.W. Roberts, for instance, was an excise commissioner, and then a district judge. There was political pressure to change this state of affairs, partly because it was felt that this was one means by which that once Sudanese entered the administrative service, it would be a means by which Sudanese could gain control of the government of their country. The more Sudanese there were in the administrative service, the better it would be. And it was not till a little later that C.L. Vikramasinghe, P. Sara and others had destroyed the myth that the Sudanese had no aptitude for administrative work. So Arthur Ramasinghe himself had noticed this. I think this comes earlier, just after the occasion when he was speaking about the local division. So Arthur Ramasinghe himself had come across some colour feeling at one stage when he attended a dinner in the northwestern province, and a GA, Graham Tyrrell, came up to him on one occasion and said, "Oh, you are the chap who ran away from Cambridge to join the civil service." Ramasinghe had not liked this comment. But C.L. Vikramasinghe had chipped in and said, "Oh, well, he ran away to get married," or something to that effect, which is, in a sense, true, because Ramasinghe was at that stage engaged a Sudanese girl. The fact of the matter was that he had sat for the civil service while he was at Cambridge and chosen to. Tyrrell's comment had been, "Who ran away from Cambridge to join the civil service so as to gain seniority." Well, Ramasinghe had, in fact, it is true, not completed his course at Cambridge, but sat for the civil service examination and been successful. He could have chosen to go to India, but preferred to also Ceylon. However, not all the civil servants were so prejudiced. Others like Horsburgh, Constantine, Seymour were quite all right. This ends that bit which should come earlier. My next query was, I inquired whether the Britishers had a sense of mission. He smiled and said that some of them didn't, some of them did. Some of them delved seriously into their work. Went on circuit, etc. Others did. Of course, the missionaries themselves generally had a sense of mission. This was at the point when the recording commenced. However, I'm afraid I have forgotten another little bit which should be included earlier at the point relating to Interview commences now. Personal guardian?
I can't say that. I don't believe so. There are lots of psychopaths among the civilians who just try to bring themselves to the notice of these dears and tell them these people want this and that and so on, and try to get really what they want as the needs of the people at large. You see, there's a nice little story which Seymour related to me before, of how a non-republic, Singhalese non-republic, used to come to the previous years at the residence. And every time a change occurred, he makes it a point to come. He's not a puppy. See? And that gives him a sort of prestige with the other people that you can call at the residence and all that. And at the same time, he got to know, shall we say, the weaknesses also that he is. And tried to help them and all that. Unfortunately, he caught a tartar in one year. And he went
training.
I believe I told you how I started to work. You see, I was lucky that day because I had to swing at once. You see, and so by swing, you have to save your life. You learn up much more rapidly than if you had been put through a theoretical course. But the training course was instituted shortly after I joined that norm, where the government agents told that they'd be the ancillary civil servants, in particular the cadets, out on circuit. You see, that was a direct cue from higher up, from the governor, from the Secretary of State. So we were taken out. The local option poll, which is fresh in my memory, up in Jaffna, local option. So Constantine used to take me with him. Then I had to decide at his own Puranama Walama. I asked, and he of those marks of his paper, do you want a tavern or not? Very few people. That was our first instruction in democratic work, the local option
work. Did you find the job inspiring and something that gave you a spirit of real service?
It depends on you. Yeah, I felt it. See, I felt that was the best way to serve the country. Because there was no opportunity to be elected to Parliament. No Parliament as such.
I was wondering about your connection, shall I say, with the average type of villager. Since your background was primarily a Western educated background, were you able to establish a rapport, an understanding with the villagers?
I was able to do it because I spoke Sinhalese. You see, but I could, was very diligent about addressing formal meetings. You see, in Sinhalese. I used to go on my horse through the villages and take all of them.
I have
a drink. You've been waiting very long for me?
Oh, half an hour.
Yeah. So, I used to go and talk to them. One of the first meetings that was arranged at a temple, Buddhist temple, I shall say it was arranged in my honor. But I was afraid to go because I said it was too formal. That I might have addressed
Sinhalese. No, I was aware of the fact that you spoke Sinhalese, but even then, wasn't there a kind of cultural gap, sort of the old Mahatma attitude and a difference coming mainly from education and social background?
Well, that occurs everywhere, doesn't it? But it does not necessarily mean that. We were unsympathetic towards the people at large. I mean, we were in full sympathy with them, wanting to help them, and so on. So there was a contact between the Sinhalese civil servant, and also, as I said, the Sinhalese civil servant had a better sense of mission. Say, generally speaking, being one of the people, see, the association with the people was a necessary, was sort of meeting.
Taking civil service as a whole before Independence Day, both British and Sinhalese civil servants, what would you say were its chief efforts? Chief virtues.
Virtues of what?
Of the whole civil service.
Why, I mentioned that at that early stage it was pressed on all the young civil servants by Sinhalese civil servants that the best way of getting the administration into Sinhalese hands was through the civil service. See, and I believe all of us felt that.
You said pressed on you, pressed by whom? By forces that come to...
By friends and the emerging politicians who are friends of ours.
There has sometimes been a complaint, or shall I say complaints by politicians, that civil servants, both British and Sylhanese, tended to show some sort of disdain towards the local MPs.
Since when?
In the 30s and 40s, you see. I know it didn't happen.
In the 30s, we had no MPs. We had no MPs, we had only state councillors.
Yes, well, state councillors. And even, say, after 48, when there were MPs, in some areas where, say, MP was not a well-known figure, there have been complaints that the AG and GSS, that these people, sort of pushing their own interests and didn't give due regard to their
constituents.
Yes, to their request.
MP, generally speaking, is very conscious of his political power. And it is just possible that some of the remnant British civil servants that run for the British Civil Service might have felt, you see, that the MPs were trying to push their own interests. It's just possible. I can give you an instance, only don't mention names. Mr. G.L.D. Davidson was land commissioner, while I was permanent secretary for agriculture and lands. A certain MP went to see him on a land matter very soon after. He rushed into my room, the purpose of his room, and complained bitterly and in freely the sort of attitude that Mr. Davidson showed him. First thing on earth showed him the noise that I had to measure my board. I tell Mr. Davidson that he should have listened more patiently to this gentleman, and I told the MP that he must not think that because he's an MP and has some authority, that he should be rude to all public officials.
Why had Davidson shown him the door?
His allegation was that the MP was trying to draw his weight about and not dictate to him what he was to do. See, it's a matter of attitudes. I mean, if the MP had tactfully approached his problem and put it to the land commissioner, I suppose Davidson would not have taken up that. It really varies to see this. Senator Newborn power sometimes has far-reaching effects.
So, say, take in the 30s, would the average type of AGA be willing to disregard public opinion on a particular issue if he felt that he
remember that in the 30s we had the Dharma Constitution operating, the executive committees were there. You see, and I'm quite certain that the public officials were quite afraid of the members of the executive committee as a body.
But hasn't political interference increased, say, in the 50s as against the 30s? Much more?
I mean, I have not measured these things, but generally speaking, I think it is.
Mm-hmm.
It was all depends upon the minister also, holding a particular portfolio.
If I may, just by showing extremes, contrast the position, even say before the 30s, the 20s, you got the civil service with a considerable amount of power.
That's right.
But yet, largely because you were Britishers, somewhat removed from the people, but gradually with the
remoteness also implied impersonal decisions.
Yes.
Which is an advantage.
Mm-hmm. With the Dalmo Constitution and independence and the Bangladesh era, you get closer and closer identification between the service and the people and more political pressure. I was wondering when this happened.
I don't know about identification, but certainly more political pressure.
Mm-hmm.
If there is an identity of interest between the administration and the people, we would be a very happy country.
Isn't there sometimes an identity of interest between particular administrators and the party in power? No.
Unfortunately, I understand that is so.
Mm-hmm.
But I can say that up to about, say, 1954, there wasn't that so marked a degree.
Mm-hmm. Now, with this increasing pressure, I was wondering whether it has retarded the ability of an officer to take a decision and take responsibility.
It may have tended to make him a little overcautious.
Mm-hmm. And what about the emphasis? Won't you say that in British times, say when you were in Kagos, the emphasis was just law and order and collecting revenue? Was that?
And redressing grievances, such as that were brought to one's notice. That's part of the maintenance of law and order, I suppose. I don't know.
With the Dalmo Constitution, would you say there was a new emphasis?
In the sense that Sudanese officials began to think that they were part of the government, with the responsibility of doing something for the people.
Mm-hmm.
See, because their responsibility was with the civilians.
And was this something more than a mere law and order concern?
Oh yes, it could be decisively a patriotic instant as an interest, I suppose.
But hasn't all these positive measures that they're taking nowadays meant an increase in load on the civil service?
The volume of work and the complexity of the problems both increased, I should say.
Now, can an universalist type of civil servant, which is a person with a very generalist background of education, handle some of these specialist jobs?
Some of these specialist jobs, what are they? The specialist is there, the expert is there to be on tap, as that keeps it, not to be on top. See? The administrator with a general background, he should be able to see through varying opinions given by different experts. At any rate, he may blunder by selecting wrong remedy, but if he is worth his job, he will see that something is done, which is a good thing. Otherwise, I mean, you'll get distracted, and of course, too many experts mean too many excuses.
Sir, did you feel that the civil service was recruitment to the civil service was too arts-oriented to, well, in British times, with classical men, and then gradually to generally to arts people.
So long as the civil service was recruited on a very high general education, which would have helped the individual to train his mind and direct his mind towards various activities. And it was a desirable form of recruitment. As I said, to make a choice between different judgments. It's a matter for your trained mind. And that training is extremely important. Of course, in certain sections, now you have to...